then you transmit the even scan lines, with each individual scan line having a horizontal sync pulse, and at the end of that, there's a vertical sync pulse. Each of these sync pulses is the strongest possible signal the transmitter can put out for a given length of time at a very specific time during the picture transmitting process. The television receiver looks for those very strong pulses and it says, hey, these are the short ones, and there's 15,750 of them per second. Oh, those are the horizontal syncing pulses that stops the picture from rolling horizontally. And then a little bit longer, let me drop it. A little bit stronger sync pulses, and there's roughly 60 of them per second. Those are the vertical syncing pulses. And the television receiver strips those away and knows exactly what to do with them so that the picture doesn't roll vertically. So you got vertical sync pulses to stop the picture from rolling vertically. You got horizontal sync pulses from stopping the picture from rolling horizontally. And in the old days of television sets, there really was a horizontal knob and a vertical knob in order to stop the picture from rolling so that your television set was in the right frequency region of horizontal scan and vertical scan for that dot that was going across the phosphor of your picture tube so that the picture didn't roll. You had to get it within the right range where the locking could take place. You had a horizontal synchronizing knob and a vertical synchronizing knob. Modern television sets do all of that so efficiently that you no longer need a knob on the front panel to do that. But the early 630 set had all of those knobs. And with a little bit of skill, you could adjust them and do some funny things with the picture. You could look at the edge of the picture by intentionally rolling it horizontally or vertically. You could see things that are beyond the edge of what's normally displayed on your cathode ray tube. And sometimes you would see technicians in the corner of the studio, so to speak, doing things that the average person didn't know was there. W-A-2-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W. Go ahead, Joe.
Thank you, Nick. My question on the subject is this. I believe the scan rate was done as well. The picture was set to 30 frames per second. Here's my question. Where did the vertical sync signal come in that happens to be, I believe, 59.75? Where did it derive that exact frequency from?
In the early days of black and white television, the horizontal scan rate was the right number of scan lines, I mean, the right rate to give you 525 lines during the vertical interval. The vertical interval was exactly 60.0 scans per second, 30 frames per second. Each vertical scan consisted of the first 60th of a second was the horizontal odd lines, and then the next 60th of a second was the even numbered scan lines, the interlay scanning technique. So 30 pictures per second, but 60 sweeps per second. And the reason 60.0 was selected is because your Con Ed power and your LiPa power was transmitting power to you at exactly 60 cycles per second. So if the television set had a less than perfect power supply, let me drop. If any hum remained in the power supply, at least the hum would create a slight darkening of the bottom of the picture versus the top of the picture. And although that was slightly annoying, at least the blackness of the hum coupled to the picture did not crawl across the picture. It set steady, and therefore you got used to it. The fact, if your power supply, if your television set had a whole lot of hum, maybe the bottom of the picture would be a little bit darker and the top of the picture would be a little bit brighter, or vice versa. And that was tolerable as long as that black bar didn't roll across the television set. That's the good news. Along came color television. And the color television required an additional piece of information to transmit, the chrominance signal. At 3.75 megacycles, I think was the frequency of the chrominance signal. In other words, your instantaneous power output of the transmitter, of the television transmitter, represented how bright that instant of the picture was. That the scan line went across your phosphor of your television set, the transmitter going up and down in power made that portion of the picture brighter and darker. But once you had to transmit 3.75 megacycles, was it 3.5 or 3.75? I think it's 3.5 megs. Anyhow, this extra signal at 3.5 megacycles told the dot not only how bright, but told it whether or not it is green, orange, blue. It gave it color information. The color information is transmitted in a very complicated manner. Let me drop it. The color television information at 3.5 megacycles is transmitted as a suppressed carrier independent sideband transmission. There is an upper sideband and the lower sideband of the 3.5 megacycle chrominance carrier that's mixed in with the picture, and the upper sideband represents the in-phase information, and the lower sideband represents the quadrature information. You need the in-phase and quadrature in order to properly represent a vector phase angle, 0 to 360 degrees. So the phase angle of chrominance tells it whether or not the picture should be green, orange, red, and so on. The magnitude of the chrominance signal at 3.5 megacycles tells you how intense that color is. The main picture is transmitted at the carrier frequency. 54 to 60 megacycles is channel 2, for instance, and the carrier is 1.25 megs above the low end. So 55.25 megacycles is the main carrier. As that amplitude goes up and down, the picture becomes brighter and dimmer. 3.5 megacycles above that is the chrominance carrier frequency. And the carrier is suppressed because it's independent sideband suppressed carrier transmission. That tells it what the chromaticity of the picture is. In other words, whether it's red, green, or blue. 4.5 megacycles above the carrier is the FM modulated audio. So as you can tell, a television signal, let me drop it, is a pretty complicated thing. So you've got the amplitude modulation on the main carrier telling you luminance, which is brightness. 3.5 megacycles suppressed carrier independent sideband is telling you what color is transmitted. 4.5 megacycles is the audio FM broadcast. All right. Once they selected the chrominance frequency, 3.5 megs, 3.75, I don't know the exact frequency, but it's in that region. And Europe has a slightly different chrominance frequency than we do. Once you've selected that frequency, you recognize that that transmission superimposed on the amplitude modulation of the picture is going to create herringbone lines across the screen. If you carefully adjust either the frequency of the chrominance signal or the horizontal scan lines, you can make that herringbone performance, that extra signal that you don't want in the picture, you can make those herringbone lines stand still. You can tolerate a whole lot of undesired jazz on the picture screen, like hum as I described before, and the herringbone lines, as long as they don't move. So if you can succeed, first of all, if your filtering of those individual signals in the television set is perfect in quality, none of the herringbone signal appears on the picture screen, and none of the hum appears on the picture screen. However, not all television signals are going to be that good. They're going to be degrading in time. So the designers decided to, let me drop. They decided to carefully adjust the horizontal scan rate and vertical scan rate in order to make the artifacts that you don't desire, at least they don't move across the screen. In order to do that, the 1,575 horizontal scan lines became some other number. 15,750 was the old black and white horizontal scan lines. That became something like 1535 instead of 735. It became a slightly different number. In order for the scan lines to now come out with exactly 525 lines, with this new horizontal scan rate to come out accurately with the vertical had to move from 60 to 59 and a fraction. So that now if there's a hum signal across the screen, it's at least going to move across the screen very slowly. And so to get rid of the hum to make a power supply high enough in quality, that's easy to do. They didn't worry about that one. but the herringbone signals they knew in the beginning, before they started using surface acoustic wave filters within the television set, until those became cheap enough that you could install them on the average television set, they knew that those chrominance scan lines, the chrominance herringbone lines were going to be there. Let me drop it. And they knew that getting rid of them was going to be difficult, so therefore they set things up in order to make them at least stand still. And you can tolerate an awful lot of stuff as long as it doesn't change. In other words, I could be in the room listening to people talking. There's a 1 kilohertz note being transmitted by something in the room. And as long as that note doesn't change in frequency and doesn't change in amplitude, and as long as I'm not moving around the room, and I'm listening to people talking, pretty soon my hearing system readjusts itself, and I no longer hear that 1 kilohertz note, as long as it's not super loud. I know this to be a fact, because the spectrum analyzers made by Airborne Instrument Laboratory used to have a high-voltage power supply, where the high-voltage power supply ran at a 10 kilohertz rate. Each person we used to demonstrate the television, the spectrum analyzer to, particularly if they were a younger person, would say, "What is that squealing noise?" To which we would all say, "I don't know what you're talking about. We don't hear it." Well, we suddenly realized what was going on. We operating on these spectrum analyzers day in and day out in the factory didn't hear the 10 kilohertz note. There's a catch. You go home for the weekend, and you're away from these spectrum analyzers for Saturday and Sunday, and you come back to work Monday morning, and the first hour of working Monday morning, you hear the squealing sound in the hearing, and makes it go away. So, same thing about these herringbone lines across the screen. Pretty soon, your vision doesn't even see them, if you know what I mean. They really are there, but the super good filters they developed downrange eventually was able to completely filter it out by a very sharp filter. I wonder if you've heard any of that.
Repeater, timeout.
I wonder if you've ever heard any of that story before, Joe. WA2RYY, K2RYW in the TechNet.
No, I have not heard this story. It's a new one to me. It's actually fascinating to hear something like this. Continue.
Yeah, it turns out there's an awful lot of technology going on in that modern television set. I'm talking about even in the latter days of analog television. And now you're starting the 8VSB digital transmission techniques where 1 6-megacycle wide channel, 54 to 60 megacycles for channel 2, used to carry just one picture, one audio, one color picture, and one kind of audio. And now by digital techniques, you can put probably as many as 6 or 7 video channels and a couple of audio channels beyond that in that 1 6-megacycle bandwidth. That's the good news. A lot more information per transmitted bandwidth. The bad news is that it's very vulnerable to ignition noise, impulse static, particularly on the lower frequencies, channels 2 through 6. Are very lowly used, very often not used anymore with digital television, because the lower frequencies have a lot more impulse noise, which is falling off 6 dB per octave. By the time you get up to channel 7 through 13 in the UHF channels, it becomes a lot more tolerable. But there are certain disadvantages of digital television. We were promised that we would have the exact same range, and that's not really true. Let me drop this. The people that are more than about 30 or 40 miles from Empire State Building on Long Island are no longer watching over-the-air television. I am, but I'm on a high location that was carefully selected when I bought my house. So I've got a television aerial on my chimney, and occasionally I put the television aerial on the tower, and that's how I watch television. But the majority of people are now using other techniques like cable TV and satellite TV in order to get television reception. In the old days, if a person was willing to put up a little bit of a higher than normal television aerial in Southampton, Long Island, which is what, about 60 miles east of New York City, he was watching Empire State Building. He was getting a little bit of snow, and on certain bad weather days, he wasn't getting very much of a picture, but he was getting something tolerable. There is not a single human being in Southampton, Long Island, that's watching over the television from the Empire State Building. I'm reasonably sure of that. unless the guy has got a zillion-foot-high radio tower, if you know what I mean. So I live in the town of Huntington, a section called Dix Hills, which contains 26,000 people. There is only one house in those 26,000 people in the town of Dix Hills. There's only one house that I can find that has an operating television aerial on the roof that's getting over-the-air television. I can only find one. From time to time, I hear a rumor that there is another one. Out of 26,000, one or two people, that's a pretty small ratio. That gives you a strong hint. Let me drop.
Dinosaurs.
Dinosaurs and crazy people. That tells you that the claimed range of digital television being equal to analog television was a pretty strong fib. It didn't turn out that way. And depending how you talk to, will over-the-air broadcast free television reception always exist? I'd like to believe the answer is yes. From time to time, I hear people saying that no, it's going to disappear. And everybody's going to be watching television by way of a fiber optic or a satellite link. I hope that's not true. Because from my point of view, one of the very nice benefits of American citizenship is completely free television reception. You don't have to pay a license for a television receiver. You don't have to pay a monthly charge if you don't want to. Yes, you get extra benefits if you do. But there's something... I can afford it. Let me drop. I have enough resources that if I really cared enough, I could afford to buy the best cable TV system with every one of the premium channels. I could afford to do that. There's something about my pride in being able to receive radio signals from a long distance that Joe and I like television DXing, and our pride forces us into watching over-the-air broadcast, and we'd rather not have to pay for it. KC2WGB, KJIW. I wonder if there's an aerial on your house, John, go ahead.
KC2WGB. Oh, yes, I have an over-the-air antenna up there, and I use it. I agree with you. I do have Fios cable and all of that stuff, but I don't watch it except for maybe four interesting channels. And it gives me like almost 300 other channels that I don't pay any attention to because it's really garbage. Just garbage. And so for the four channels, I'm very interested in Science Channel, Discovery Channel, and Natural History, stuff like that. Very interesting stuff. And you do it too on the PBS system. So you know exactly what I'm watching. But all the rest, I don't need it. Thank you, Dick. That was a very good description on the television operation. And there was so much that people don't realize. I'm sure you remember that 120 KC beat that would happen between the audio 4.5 and the 3-point oscillator, the 3.5749 color chroma oscillator. And you would get that little interference, another herringbone or a check on the screen, and you would have to retune that occasionally. Yeah, there was a lot of annoying things originally. Okay, that completes the mailbag for tonight, and I think we have to go to Paul. I'm sure he's got an interesting report for us. So back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
Yeah, I suddenly realized the chrominance frequency is 3.579545545. Literally. That crazy frequency was carefully chosen so that combined with slightly adjusted 1750 horizontal scan lines and the vertical used to be 60 fields per second, became 59 in a fraction, in order to make all of that mathematically come out right so that all of the artifacts on the screen, as bad as they were, they didn't move. They would sit still. Therefore, they came up with all these crazy numbers to make that come out right and still be compatible with an old-fashioned monochrome set. See, when we started transmitting color TV, you had to make sure that all of the extra hardware and transmitting techniques, let me drop them. For the first X number of years, you had to make sure that the color transmitting techniques would be reverse compatible so that all of your grandmothers with old-fashioned black and white monochrome television sets would still be able to watch a black and white picture even though it was a color transmission. So you had to be very careful as to how you readjusted things. You didn't go so far that the horizontal hold knob and the vertical hold knob would run out of range. That's part of why some of these crazy numbers came up. Paul, I hear tell that Orion was a launch. I hear tell that people are pretty happy. Give us some specifics about that. WS2N with the Space Report. K2RI WZNet. Go ahead, Paul.
And before I do it, isn't it true that hams, that crystal out of the old TVs, the old color TVs, you know, for the, to try to get on 80 to 3.5, 7954 crystals?
Without a doubt, because so darn many crystal manufacturing factories, crystal filter, crystal reference oscillator manufacturing factories had to be supplying that crystal for the television receivers, because television color receivers were starting to become popular. That particular crystal, which in the early days was probably $10, eventually because of mass production, probably came down to 50 cents, so to speak. Therefore, they became universally available. Therefore, a whole lot of equipment that needed a reference oscillator, frequency counters, and clocks, and whatever. You'd be amazed how many clocks and wristwatches and so on used 3.579545 as the crystal determining the reference frequency for making the function work correctly. So that became a very popular frequency for all kinds of things. And so, yeah, some hams I'm sure went on that frequency, and some hams eventually, let me drop. Some hams eventually designed frequency synthesizers that use that as the reference frequency, and then by using other fancy digital techniques, it could derive other frequencies from that. I think the George L. Belki, the BLK, well, I'm trying to remember the three-letter abbreviation for the first popular ham radio synthesizer that was manufactured 1974 or so. A digital circuit which had three knobs by which you could set the 2 meter transmit frequency and three knobs by which you could set the 2 meter receive frequency on the synthesizer, and you plugged it into your ordinary 2 meter transceiver like an IC2AT, no, I'm trying to think of the brand name, the Drake 2C, can't think of the name of the thing right now. You plugged this thing in instead of the crystal, instead of buying a zillion crystals so that you could go on various repeaters, and now let me drop it. With this GLB, that's the brand name, George L. Belki, the GLB synthesizer. Very popular piece of electronics as a kit, and also built up. George L. Belki lived in the Buffalo area of New York State, and he designed this very desirable circuit. I still own one. It's an antique. Works like a charm. And now you could go to all 800 possible channels in the 2 meter ham band with the GLB synthesizer. Whereas in those days, very few of us could afford to buy more than two or three sets of crystals in order to go on two or three repeaters. And you had to buy a transmitting crystal and a receiving crystal for the rigs of that day. And it got expensive pretty fast. So before GLB came along, very few of us could go on more than a couple of repeaters. After the GLB synthesizer, we could now go on every single repeater that was in our area. Over to you, Paul. And by the way, Paul, I'm not sure your antenna is aimed quite as accurately today. I'm hearing a little bit of noise on your signal. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, I moved it a little bit. I hope that's better. I copy, Dick.
Copy is quite good, George, so please proceed.
Very good. I remember a lot of people talking about the that crystal years ago. Go around, and then they used to get a hold of it, grind it down, and raise the frequency, use it for different parts of the 80 and 75 meter band. Very good. I thought that was the one they would get. That was popular. Yeah, Dick, I just wanted to talk about, of course, Orion. And I'm glad we're doing good work in this country now with that spacecraft. Because the other countries are moving along. You know, China has their very ambitious space program for one country acting alone. They just opened up a new launch facility on the coast of China. It'll be, it's their first coastal launch port, spaceport, and Wang Chang is the name of it. And now they'll be able to build bigger rockets. They'll have capability of doing that because they can float in much bigger first stages, bigger equipment could be brought in, and bigger engines, all that. So they plan on eventually having regular flights to the moon, and you know, it's a form of competition. But here we are with Orion, naturally with this setup, space launch system that will eventually launch it. We'll have a
repeater timeout. Repeater timeout. Cancel.
Have leadership in the space race. Complete the way it should be. Of course, we'll have other countries on board. The Orion that went up did not have a service module. It had a mass simulator attached to it, duplicating the service module, but eventually that will be built by the European Space Agency in the future. So what we really had on board was the Orion spacecraft, a launch abort system built by Orbital Science, a private company that built that. And the whole system was launched on the Delta IV Heavy. Delta IVs bolted together. Very nice launch. It was delayed the first day, actually due to a boat downrange, and then this constant, shutting the whole system down and bringing it back up again. Valve failures. There's these large valves that they use for the liquid hydrogen and the liquid oxygen. This particular rocket is one of those. It doesn't fly on rocket fuel. It doesn't fly on the kerosene-based fuel. It does fly similar to a space shuttle type of rocket engine. The rocket engine, the space shuttle, had liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen, and so does the Delta IV rockets. So those three big rockets you were looking at were being fired by cryogenically cooled hydrogen and oxygen. And the reason you saw the yellow flame that comes out of those three rockets, different than the what you see coming out of the three main engines of the shuttle, which just look like water vapor, is the ablative inside of the fairing, the bell nozzle that sticks out of that. Each one of those rockets. So these rockets, of course, are not reusable. The shuttle RS-25s were reusable. My throwaways are expendable. They wind up going into the Pacific Ocean, in this case the Atlantic Ocean. Most of these Delta IV rockets, heavy design, have flown out of Vandenberg Airport, a couple have flown out of Florida. And they use these rockets to put this test Orion into two orbits. First orbit brought it up to about 500 miles, and then the final stage on the Delta IV brought it up to its goal of 3,600 miles. And then after reaching its peak, it came on back down and came through the atmosphere and heated up that heat shield an ablative heat shield, similar but more advanced than the old Apollos and Geminis that they had years ago. And only about 20% of the heat shield is probably disintegrated from the from that whole system. So, you know, from what I heard, it really was a 100% test. WS2N, they tested everything on board that you could imagine. The heat shield, of course, the avionics, make sure all the electronics work inside the Orion spacecraft. The 11 parachutes all performed as designed, a series of parachutes to that had to come out to land this 40,000 pound thing into the Pacific Ocean. Check out all the computers on board, make sure the separation events that had to occur worked out, such as the launch abort system. We drop it. Now what's going to happen with the spacecraft now that they brought it back? There's another one being built, and that one will be used on another unmanned flight, probably in 2018. And they're going to send that out around the moon and bring that back. And with that one, you won't see the Delta IV heavy launch system, but you'll see the space launch system. That's the biggest one ever designed by anybody. And that'll fly the next one that's being built, the next Orion, to the moon and back for a complete test. What happens to the one that that they just launched? They're going to reuse that and test that as well. They call it the AA2 test, or ascent abort 2 test. Not many people even know or care about this particular test, but it's going to be done in Florida. They hired Orbital Science to get a hold of a big rocket, and they're going to use an old Peacekeeper rocket. They're going to put that to use. They're going to take this Orion spacecraft that was just launched, refurbish it, and put it on top of the Peacekeeper rocket, put it down in Florida. On top of it, on top of the Orion, they're going to put a complete launch abort system. What they had was a semi-launch abort system on this particular flight. That functioned properly. It pulled the main cover, as you will, off the whole Orion system. That part of the test is now complete. But they need to have the main rockets of the launch abort system actually pull a spacecraft away from a rocket, simulating a failed rocket about to explode. So they're going to take a Peacekeeper rocket, which, I don't know, I think it has half a million pounds for us, something like that. Just really a solid booster rocket. And they're going to put the Orion spacecraft on top of that, and they're going to launch it down in Florida up to about 20,000 feet, about 4 miles up. And they're going to simulate an emergency there. The launch abort system will launch and pull the spacecraft away from the Peacekeeper rocket. This all will happen like in milliseconds. And then after that, this launch abort system will pull it up few miles up to about 47,000 feet. Probably about a little over 9 miles. And then from there, the parachutes will open, and they'll bring it back down to, and then you'll see the other test I mentioned earlier, the EM-110, the test, the exploration mission 1 test, which will bring it out to them. After that, in 2021, full-up test, spacecraft, Orion, with the service module built by European Space Agency Yeah, complete baseline system, which will consist of four rockets in the central core, similar to the RS-25 that were, in fact, it will be the RS-25 design that were in the space shuttle, except instead of having three, they'll have four of them to the port starboard side of that. You'll have these solid booster rockets built by ATK, creating probably seven and a half million pounds of thrust to launch this whole setup to the moon and back. Let me drop it. Interesting part of the test I mentioned, the AA2, the ascent abort test. The reason they use the peacekeeping rocket, that will be able to duplicate the maximum Q that the Space Launch System has. Maximum Q is what they use. You'll hear the flight control always talk about, you know, if we're getting to maximum Q in all these launches. That's the time frame when the atmosphere pressure relationship to the speed of the rocket is the greatest pressure, atmospheric pressure that is created on the rocket at that time. And that's the exact time when they're going to duplicate an emergency and have the launch board system pull the Orion spacecraft away from the Peacekeeper rocket. So, just wanted to mention that whole setup. If you have any questions about Orion, we can talk about that. And after that, we'll talk about Dawn. We haven't talked about Dawn. We always talk about the Pluto mission coming up. New Horizon. But we should talk about Dawn as well. That will be coming up to its main part of its mission in 2015 as well, because Pluto is 2015, Dawn is also 2015, going up to the orbit around the asteroid. Back to you, Dick. If any questions, I know it's a lot, but try to cover as best we can. Of course, Orion is the main topic for this week. K2RIWWS2M.
If I remember correctly, Paul, this particular mission of Orion was going to go up to a elliptical orbit of something like 3,600 miles of altitude, then come back down into the atmosphere, and I think that was going to be simulating close to the velocity at which a reentrance from a lunar orbit would take place. Therefore, if you want to give full exposure of the heat shield to the high velocity of a lunar return, that's a way of doing it. Is that approximately what took place? Did the heat shield experience the high velocity? See, an ordinary low-altitude orbit is 17,500 miles an hour, whereas when you come back from the moon, I think you're entering the atmosphere something closer to 25,000 miles an hour. So I wonder if Orion's test that just took place was anything like that. Over to you, Paul, WS2N, K2LIW.
Yes, that's right. What they planned on doing was exactly what happened. They got up to 3,600 miles, a couple of miles above that. And when it came back, acceleration from the gravity really pulled it in. And they got it up to the desired speed, which was 20,000 miles, I think, which is not as fast as coming back to the moon. You know, you're right about the 25,000 miles per hour. At 20,000 miles, they got the heat shield up to 4,000 degrees, which is the test that they wanted, which is roughly, he said, about 80% of temperature, that would, it would go up to, if it was coming back from the moon, which is 5,000 degrees. And that would be at, like what, as you stated, 25,000 miles per hour. If it was coming back from Mars, now you're looking at a little over 30,000 miles per hour. And temperature is not all that much different, but instead of going coming back from the moon, for instance, at 5,000, it would be about 5,500 degrees to the heat shield. Don't forget the morning the heat shield, they tested the tiles. This thing has tiles similar to the space shuttle on the cone part of the spacecraft, and that gets up to around 3,000 degrees. When I heard it all, well, they have thousands of different sensors, and I think it's like 1,100 different sensors inside the spacecraft, and it detected all of this. And if you watched it, it was pretty good. They had cameras on board. Cameras showed pictures there at the 3,600 mile altitude. Cameras actually have plans in the work. They shut that down. Some of the other electronics as they went through the Van Allen belt. Well, nothing got damaged or anything going through the radiation belt. Back to you, Dick.
The recent issue of the last couple of days of the Space Report showed that the solar cycles we're going through right now are much more calm than previously, which to a certain degree is bad. That means we don't get as much great radio propagation as you do with a high sunspot number. It looks like the sun is about to go through a magnetic field polarization reversal, and so we're possibly going to have a large number of 11-year solar cycles that are going to be kind of small. The bad news about that is you don't get as much solar wind, therefore you don't get as much protection from cosmic rays. As such, the cosmic ray shielding effect we get from the sun is significantly decreased. And so now when they estimate how long you can put a astronaut in orbit where he's exposed, or in space where he's exposed to all the cosmic rays, something like 300 days maximum without him getting a lifetime exposure, whereas it used to be over 1,000 days that you could put a man in space because the sun was much more active. So that's going to be affecting how high and for how long we use things above the Van Allen belt shield. Put astronauts on the International Space Station. Let me drop the space report. The NASA space report. I don't think it's NASA. I'm trying to remember which report it is. It's something that I get every couple of days on my internet, on my email. Did Orion land in the water the way it was supposed to? Did essentially everything work, Paul? Did it get on this particular mission a 100% report card, or did it get a 97% report card? Could you, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
Well, they've been saying 100%, but I'm going to give it a 99.9 because they have these airbags that inflate at the very end, and I think two of them were completely inflated, and then the other two, one didn't. The is when the spacecraft is coming down on an angle, so you're hitting the edge. Parachutes don't start slowing things down until around 300 miles per hour, and after all the 11 parachutes have done its work, it landed at 20 miles per hour. So that's not bad. Very good. It's just what they were looking for. One position as for stable. Stable one is upright. Stable two is exactly the way they planned, which is very good. I'm gonna probably is WS, come on. Okay. I think you asked me another question, but I forgot what it was.
I know that at the very end, I think there was supposed to be three very large parachutes at approximately...
Had its own little tube chutes that pulled it off. The maneuvering thrusters, and they're all over the spacecraft.
It ended up in stable mode one, right side up. If it had landed in stable mode two, upside down, those airbags inflating are going to...
To do that, 4,000 pounds, including state to state. They have to have all these permits. And then they essentially pump all the water out. Now you're looking at a spacecraft. That's the way it looks.
Yes, Dick. A floating dry dock, they're huge. And what they'll do is they... Those huge Zodiacs, that's a Webtail. Navy has them. They're huge.
Well done. This method of recovery, Paul, I am guessing it's being used because in the case of Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo, you recovered the spacecraft by way of a helicopter. In the case of Orion, where we're talking about 44,000 pounds, I am guessing that's above the weight that you can safely recover with a helicopter. Therefore, they're using this sea recovering technique. I'm making some guesses on that. Is that possibly the philosophy here, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
Probably not. The idea of the anchorage, this system, is to leave the crew on board. You might remember with the Mercury and Gemini flights, Apollo flights. It wasn't until the Apollo type craft came back from Skyland that they did something similar to this. They would actually hoist it up to the whole spacecraft onto the deck of the Hornet or whatever aircraft carrier they were using. This system with the anchorage, they'd like to leave the astronauts on board. I guess they're coming back very long extended missions. The spacecraft is designed, even without a habitat module, to last 21 days. Apollo wasn't. Apollo, which, you know, was like a top 2-week mission. If they're coming back from maybe months in orbit around the moon, looking at an asteroid, which is one of the plans that they have for Orion, or coming back from Mars, these people are going to be legless. Then there's no way they're going to be happy opening up a hatch and jumping into a little cage like they used to do and getting hoisted onto a helicopter and brought back. There's no way. They'll leave them in the spacecraft. And by the way, there might be four of them. In Apollo, they had three. This thing carries four. They'll leave them in there, floated into the anchorage, up all the water, and that's how they're going to get their astronauts out. Back to you, Dick.
And then the anchorage, I presume, comes back to a harbor on the west coast. I'm assuming they land in the Pacific. A harbor on the west coast, maybe San Diego. And then by land, the craft is brought back to Cape Kennedy or Cape Canaveral. Is that the process, Paul? Where do you land the anchorage? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, that ship will be going to San Diego. Of course, San Diego is a big Navy port. And from there, they'll truck it back to Florida. They'll refurbish it, and they'll use it on the AA-2 test mission a couple years from now. That's the plan for it. That's what they're going to do. If you have a crew coming back, they'll probably do the same thing, except the crew will get out of the spacecraft on board the anchorage. And, they'll probably fly them home with a helicopter. But aircraft that will be brought back. Originally, the Orions were planned on being reusable for flight, but that's all changed over the years. And for every flight they're going to have a new Orion. These happen to be reusable ones because of this one in particular, because they're going to use it for another test. Back to you.
On this Orion mission, they landed in the Pacific. Roughly how far out to sea away from San Diego? So where in the Pacific did it land, the Paul?
Said it was 116 degrees longitude. So I did hear one report, it was around 230 miles off the coast of Baja, California, and then 600 miles off the coast of San Diego. So that was the planned location. It landed within a mile of the predicted location. They got real good at doing this. Remember the early days, they would wind up downrange. Scott Carpenter, I think it was, he wound up 600 miles downrange in his Mercury spacecraft. So they got real good at this. I mean, if you think about all these people here, the Russians, they come back and land on land. They always land in Kazakhstan. They don't wind up in the Ural Mountains somewhere. They're pretty good.
If Scott Carpenter landed 600 miles downrange and you have a ship ready there for recovery, which is 600 miles in the wrong location, how long did it take to go and recover him, Paul? Run that one by again. Go ahead.
In those days, they had more than one, ship out there. And then they would fly a helicopter out to get him, so probably pretty quick. I mean, even on this mission, they had backups. And, for instance, the Anchorage didn't pick up. They had another ship out there that picked, they gave the work to somebody else, and the Anchorage was just dedicated for the Orion. And by the way, they could have done it a lot sooner. They actually let the Orion float around for about an hour without having a crew go by. For two reasons: they wanted to check it for see how it did in the water, water seepage and all of that. They want to run tests afterwards. There's no reason to get it out real quick. It wasn't sinking or anything, so otherwise they would have done that right away. In fact, the crews didn't get, they came out in Zodiacs, and they didn't get near it for at least an hour, and they want to make sure there were no fumes, hazardous fumes from the hydrazine fuel. And it all worked out okay. Exactly the plan. This WS plan.
If one of the airbags on the top does not inflate, or the ones that did inflate, is that enough to still get you from stable mode 2 back to stable mode 1, Paul?
Yeah, maybe it's 1. But, more is better. If you took a bottle of soda and you just blew up a small balloon from the opening of that soda bottle. You put that thing in upside down, that thing's going to flip up right side up real quick. That's the idea.
Sounds like they got double redundancy there then. I did read that New Horizons just came back out of hibernation. It is the spacecraft that has the longest number of miles traveled so far to a single destination. So it's the longest single destination spacecraft, just came back out of hibernation. I don't know whether or not it's going to stay out of hibernation from now on as it approaches Pluto, which takes place on, is it July 4th or July 14th that it has the nearest flyby? And I guess it's going to be taking all kinds of data of Pluto and all of its satellites from now until next July. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
Yes, 5 known moons. I was going to talk about Dawn, but I think New Horizons is really, of course, a very interesting topic. I know we've talked about it a lot. It just came out of its final hibernation. It's gone through, I think they said, 18 different hibernations since 2000 and, I would say 2004, but it was beginning of 2006 when it launched. So it's almost 9 years up there. And it's really going to start doing science now as far as... this is its last hibernation, to answer that question. Not going back to sleep anymore. And, January 15th, it's going to really start doing the investigation of Pluto. We've got many, many months. It's got all kinds of telescopic, telescopes on it, cameras, equipment. So you're going to have plenty of good results. April and May, June, leading up to the closest approach. Yeah, it was, you're right, July 14th, I read. And then you got many more months after that. They'll continue to take pictures and all kinds of tests. So it should be exciting. Compared to the best pictures of Hubble, they said, in February or so, you're going to start seeing better resolutions from this spacecraft. You know, think about how many months after that they'll be taking pictures of all the moons, five moons.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
A Kuiper Belt object. So, they have a couple in mind. Back to you, Dick.
I'm going to let the machine thoroughly drop and see if we can restore the Eastern repeater. It's back. Okay, all's well. So as of February or March, New Horizons will be giving us a higher resolution picture of Pluto than the Hubble Space Telescope. And after that, it's going to get better and better. And so that closest flyby, how close is that? Pluto was way out there, 39 astronomical units, as I remember. But the closest flyby is going to be how close, Paul? K2RIW.
I'm trying to remember. Was it 6,000 miles? I forget. Don't know. I mean, it's not going to be like hundreds. but it's going to be close enough for so they can, with their cameras, they can see the ground. I really don't know. I'll find out on the web. Maybe it will be close. Whatever it is, it's going to be a lot better than anything that we've ever seen before, that's for sure. So, and I want to see the moons, too. You got to see that. And then off to the Kuiper Belt. A couple of years later, they'll be using this thing again. That's going to be pretty exciting, too. Just don't know what, how big a diameter the one that they're going to find is, whether or not it's going to look like Pluto. They think Pluto is a Kuiper Belt object that's been, wound up in our textbooks as the ninth planet. Back to you, Dick.
When you look at that every couple of days space report, and they talk about the near-Earth flyby objects, all those objects that come near the Earth are rated in units of lunar distance, and the closest object might be one lunar distance, and many of the objects they rate there are 5 or 10 lunar distances as the closest approach to the Earth. A lunar distance is 240,000 miles. It sounds to me like... New Horizons is going to be flying by Jupiter at a very small fraction of a lunar distance, is what it sounds like. You made a guess that it might be 6,000 miles. That's super close. So I got two questions. Number one, right now, what is our belief as to the total number of satellites that Pluto has? question is, have they chosen the flyby in such a way that the horizons will be deflected by the gravity assist of Pluto